enslaved and persecuted. So the Rambam's own answer is that Hashem never said the Egyptians are the ones that are going to do it. Yes, the Kodesh Baruch Hu decreed there would be servitude and persecution, but he did not decree that the nation of Egypt do it, and certainly he did not decree that any individual do it. So essentially Hashem matches up the billions of individual decisions with his predetermined results. So in a sense, the results are predetermined, but who the actors are not predetermined. That is a function of Bechira. And for that reason, the actors, the bad actors, are responsible for what they do. The Ramban does have a problem with that argument, because the Ramban nevertheless says, even if it be the case that Hashem does not decree what the Egyptians do, but if Hashem said, this is the result that I decree, then anybody who carries out that result is not doing anything wrong. In other words, what would be wrong with it? In other words, yes, God did not make an Egyptian do it, but what did the Egyptian do? That which God decreed. Therefore, the Ramban argues that why should there be moral condemnation for that? So the Ramban gives two other answers. Again, it's an interesting idea. The Ramban says that intention is very much important here. That is, even if Hashem decreed that the Jews were to be slaves, did the Egyptians do this because they were carrying out the will of God? Did they know it was the will of God? And was that their motivation? Only HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows. And if their motivation was to be cruel, therefore there is no defense that they are carrying out the will of Hashem. So that's one aspect, the idea of motivation and kavana. And the second aspect, which also needs a lot of explanation, is the Egyptians went beyond the parameters of the decree. In other words, God decreed that the Jewish people would suffer in three stages. Geirus, they would feel like aliens, like strangers. Avdus, they would be enslaved, and they would be afflicted. But God, so theoretically what could have happened was for 209 and a half years, they could have just felt like strangers, and then for 2 months they could have had slavery, and then they could have had affliction. But it could have been very, very short. The Egyptians went beyond that which God decreed. Now, of course, that raises a lot of interesting questions. Number one, how is one supposed to know if you're going beyond what Hashem decreed? How do you know what Hashem decreed exactly? Number two, are we getting back to the quandary of a human being? Can a human being do beyond what Hashem decreed? So, once again, we're not necessarily saying that they were able to enslave the people more than God actually decreed. Everything that happened was God's decree, but I think we can say they enslaved the Jewish people more than God openly declared, meaning everything that happens is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's decree. But the point is, he normally doesn't tell us ahead of time. Here, he told us ahead of time, but what he told us ahead of time was not of the same magnitude. Was it, could have been a lesser magnitude than the Egyptians actually did. In other words, what actually happened was indeed Hashem's decree, but the Egyptians went beyond what was communicated to be Hashem's decree. This is what the Ramban says. So again, it's a tricky thing, but there's one more important question to this, which really comes up in this parsha. This question only answers why the Egyptians are accountable, even though they are fulfilling a divine mandate. And the Rambam's essential answer is that that divine mandate did not interfere with their choice, because no individual Egyptian was told to enslave anybody. It was totally a matter of choice, and yes, even if Hashem wanted the Jewish people to be enslaved, he did not instruct anybody to do it, and if that is the case, free will is still preserved. But the Rambam goes further, and that is not a good answer for what we find by the Ten Makos. Hashem hardened Paro's heart. Because Hashem hardens Paro's heart does seem to indicate that Paro, had he been left to his own choice, would have let the Jewish people go at some point. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it were, took away his free will. And by taking away his free will, Paro essentially set himself and his people up for punishment after punishment after punishment after punishment. And you certainly cannot give the answer here that no Egyptian lost their free will, because hardening Paro's heart certainly suggests that he did lose his free will, right? In other words, the answer the Rambam gives does not answer this part of it. So here the Rambam goes into a long discussion, and he discusses it in two places. He discusses it both in the Mishneh Torah, in Hilchos Tshuva, and he also discusses it in the Shmona Prakim. What are the Shmona Prakim? This is a very interesting book. You know, the Rambam wrote a Perish on Mishnah. I wrote it in Arabic, but it was translated into Hebrew. And as part of his Perish L'Mishnayis, he also wrote a Hakdama to both the Mishnah as a whole, which is very important. That's the whole Yisod of Torah Shabbat Peh. And he wrote a particular Hakdama to Pirkei Avos that is called Shmoneh Perakim, the eight chapters. Yeah, everything's in Arabic. Yeah.
So does that mean you can't make a fine deal, let's say?
Well, you can always make a deal, but, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt. Indeed, because it is a translation. No, it's a very old translation. It's a translation by people who themselves are Rishonim. So it has a certain cheshivas, although there are more modern translations from the Arabic, which are actually easier to read. It's interesting, you know. The translators from the Arabic, again, translation is a complicated business. Because the Ibn Tibbon family, who translated all of the Rambam's Arabic writings, that includes the Perish of Mishnayis, the Morin of Buchim, the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam himself wrote in Hebrew. So they translated into Hebrew using an Arabic sentence structure. Now, apparently, I'm not a big expert in it, but apparently the Arabic sentence structure is different than the Hebrew sentence structure. And the translations are hard to read. That's why you will actually find that any of these translations are very rough. So they actually have some modern translations, some Vinay Torah, Sephardic Vinay Torah from Yemen. They were able to, you know, they knew Arabic well, and they translated it in a much more flowing Hebrew. And I see now in a lot of the new editions of Shas, they're printing the new translation, but they keep the old translation as an appendix because Lamdonim are used to the old translation, so they keep both around. But it's interesting, Pirkei Avos in the Mishnah is only five prakim, and there's a sixth chapter, that's a brisa. So it's interesting, the Hakdama is eight prakim, right? So the Shmoneh Prakim is an eight-chapter introduction to a five-chapter Masechta. And in the Shmoneh Prakim, the Rambam goes through many, many issues about free will and how you can change yourself, etc. So this was an earlier discussion. The Mishneh Torah he wrote towards the latter half of his life. Perish Mishnayis he wrote when he was much younger, but he has a similar discussion in both places. And the Rambam says the following: we know that although HaKadosh Baruch Hu often punishes people for their sins in Olam Haba after they die, but we also know that there's also such a concept as an onesh in Olam Hazeh. A person, God forbid, might die, a person might get sick, a person might lose an arm or a leg, and all of that might be an onesh for the pre-existing averos that a person does. So the Rambam says the following: the same way HaKadosh Baruch Hu might punish a person by the loss of a visual capacity, or the loss of a walking capacity, or the loss of a writing capacity, so too there may be a severe level of onesh where, because of a person's habitual sins, HaKadosh Baruch Hu punishes him by taking away his koach of bechira, so that he will not be able to do tshuva on the sins that he's done. Meaning, technically, the Rambam argues, a person is never punished for the sins he commits because he lacks bechira. That would not be just. But if Hashem decrees that because of a person's averos, he deserves X number of punishments, but it's likely that the person will do tshuva and get out of those punishments, one of the Darche Hashem is to be moneya from that person the capacity of tshuva, so he can continue to get punished, not for what he's doing in a state of lack of bechira, but because of what he did before that state. Now the Rambam points out the phrase, Hashem hardened Paro's heart, only appears in the latter five plagues, not in the first five plagues. In the first five plagues, it says Pyro hardened his own heart. So the concept was, because of those five plagues and because of the servitude and the what he did to Bnei Israel before the plagues even started, Pyro and his nation deserved a certain magnitude of onus. But Derech HaTeva, they would have done tshuva at the very beginning of all of these plagues, but that wouldn't have exhausted the punishment to which Hashem decreed that they were deserving. So part of their onesh was, he was moneah from them, the capacity of tshuva and change, so that they would get punished, not for keeping the Jews in Egypt at the point that they lost their free will, but for everything they had done over the preceding 210 years. This is the Rambam's famous idea that it's a rare situation, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu can be moneya darche hatshuva from a person by taking away their normal koach of bechirat.
So, didn't the Rav just say that the Egyptians went beyond what was decreed? So why would he have to remove their free will in order to reach what he decreed? Sounds like they...
That's exactly the point. I mean, the problem is, let's say they went beyond what Hashem decreed. So they are deserving of X amount of punishment. However, because Hashem built into the world a concept called tshuva, had they done tshuva, Hashem wouldn't have been able to punish them. But since they were deserving of such a punishment, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu deprived them of free will so that they wouldn't be able to do tshuva, and therefore the punishment that they deserve for going beyond Hashem's will, whatever it would be able to find its realization. In other words, Hashem's Midah of Rachamim normally gives us an escape hatch called tshuva. He didn't want to give them that escape hatch. So the mechanism for not giving them that escape hatch is taking away free will. But again, the Rambam's making a point. They're not being punished because of the enslavement that occurred after that point. They are, everything they got was something that was already deserving because of the 210 years, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu was monea from them the Darchei HaTshuva until their punishment was exhausted. Now, others say it a little differently. Others give this analogy. That is, well, okay, so how could Pyro be responsible for lack of free will? Well, one might look at God hardening Pyro's heart as the notion of addiction to sin, and that is, let's say a person is a drunk driver, right? He drinks, and as a result, he's drunk, he gets behind an automobile, and he kills people. Now, he could make the argument, theoretically, that at the time I killed people, I really didn't know what I was doing. I couldn't control myself. And in fact, a drunk person, if there's nobody around to stop him, he doesn't have the self-control not to get behind the wheel. So l'chora, every drunk driver should always have the defense that he was not in control of himself at the time that he drove and at the time that he went into the accident. So what is our answer? Our answer is, even though you reached a point of no control, and at the point of that, you know, you can argue, I shouldn't be accountable, but you can be accountable for allowing yourself to reach that condition. And that's the way Averos are. It could very well be, when a person keeps on sinning and sinning and sinning, even in terms of addiction, he kind of loses the ability to change. But he could, this is, I think, different than the Rambam, but nevertheless, he could still be accountable for everything he does at that point because he allowed himself through his own choices to put himself in that condition. Now, the Rambam's learning differently. According to this explanation, he could actually be responsible for everything he did after he lost his free will, because he lost his free will as a result of free will. And therefore, all of the consequences are still part of his volitional decision.
Rambam saying he can be punished for the sins he did when he does not have free will?
I'm giving you another explanation. The Rambam's explanation seems to be that he's not punished for that. The Rambam's explanation is that the lack of free will simply puts him in a position where he doesn't have the koach of tshuva, and therefore he's manash on everything that he did before. I'm giving you another explanation, which is not in the Rambam, that he could even be manash on what he does after he loses free will, because the loss of free will was a totsa'ah, it was a consequence of the decisions that he made. You know, in many places, we paint ourselves into a corner. We put ourselves in a point of almost beyond no return. But we have an achrayus for that because we put ourselves in that situation. Now, there's another explanation, which is not the Rambam. They say in the name of the Maral, although I was not able to find it inside, but it's everyone says it in the name of the Maral. And that is, Hashem hardening Pyro's heart is bichlal, not taking away Bechira at all. It's giving him Bechira, because here's the idea. The Makos are something that would break a normal person's will. If I wanted to do something bad, and I have these awesome makos, dam, tzvardeya, kinim, they would break my will. And normally, Hashem allows us to be influenced by these external events, because that's also Hashem's rachamim, meaning if you're not going to do tshuva out of love, if you're not going to do tshuva out of a sense of conscience, I will give you extraordinary experiences in your life that will bring you to tshuva. Hashem did not want to show Pyro that rachmanis. So when it says Hashem pardoned Pyro's heart, the Maral says, what it means is HaKadosh Baruch Hu made Pyro impervious to pressure. Meaning things did not affect him. And Mimela, when he made the decision to do tshuva, to let the Jews go or not to let the Jews go, he was actually exercising 100% of a free will without the siyata dishmaya that the Makos would normally contribute, right? So that's an amazing thing. That for Kert, Hashem Hiksha Slave Paro is not a taking away of Bechira, it actually is giving him that Bechira, because, in other words, he was the freest person who ever lived, because he was the person who was not broken or afraid of external events. He objectively was able to assess what he wanted to do, and he wanted to go in the direction of Rishus. So the Maral actually says that for Kert, this is actually a good exercise of the notion of Bechira. Okay. Now, to go back a little bit, we know this is a famous Chazal, that at the end of last week's Parsha, what happened? At the end of last week's Parsha, Moshe Rabbeinu, goes to the Ziknei Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu was a very, very reluctant leader. He did not want to be a leader. He kept on telling HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm not worthy, I can't talk, they're not going to listen to me. He brought up every possible argument. He says, I'm not on the Madrega, they're not on the Madrega, meaning I don't deserve to be the Manig, and they don't deserve to be redeemed, and they're not going to listen to me, and Paro's not going to listen to me, and I'm on Aral Sefasayim, I don't talk well, etc. And yet, Moshe Rabbeinu goes. And it seems like there's a lot of hope here. He does the miracle. He changes the mate into a snake. His hand turns leprous, which is a riot to him not to speak Lashon Hara. He pours blood. This is before the makkah. Some water turns into blood. But the first thing Pyro does, it backfires. It seems like an awful, awful mistake. Because what happened is that Pyro says, oh, you guys, you're lazy. You got too much time in your hands. That's why you're looking for civil rights and freedom and everything else. So Pyro says, from now on, people have to gather their own straw. Apparently they mix straw into bricks. I'm not sure about the manufacturing process. And every person had to produce a certain number of bricks. But Pyro says, you got to come up with the same bricks, and you have to gather your straw instead of it being given to you. So the Jewish people are very, very bitter. They say to Moshe, why did you even come? You made things worse. And Moshe comes to the Ribbono Shel Olam, Moshe Rabbeinu says, Lama harayisa liyam hazeh. Why have you done bad things to this nation? Lama zeh shalachtani. Why did you send me? Umeyaz basi al avdecha, from the time that I came, heyra liyam hazeh. Umeyaz basi, from the time you came to your servant, we have made things worse, vatzeh lo itzalta. And nothing has happened, right? They have not been saved. So the Medrash makes a very interesting comment. The Medrash makes a comment that Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Umeyaz basi alavdecha." I'm sorry, not basi, basa. Umeyaz basa alavdecha. From the time you have come, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, you are using the word us to complain about my hashgacha. Umei oz basa el avdecha. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, the very same oz that you use as a sign that I have abandoned the Jewish people, that oz is going to be a sign of redemption. As we know in the Shira Sayam, the Shira of Kriyas Yamsuf, oz yashir Moshe. Right? May oz. So the Mefarshim explained that in reality, it was making the Gezeira worse that actually enabled the redemption. Why is that so? Because here is the thing. Under the Bris Bein Absarim that was communicated to Avram, the Jewish people should have been in Mitzrayim for 400 years. HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out after 210 years because had we stayed another second, we would have been under the 50th level of Tumah. We would have been irredeemable. But the question still is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, although we don't really understand why Hashem is so limited, but these are his own self-imposed limitations, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is bound by his own decrees. So even when HaKadosh Baruch Hu annuls a decree, he has to be able to redefine the Gezeira in such a way that it was still Mekuyim. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't simply decree and ignore. He can only decree and redefine. Thus, for example, the famous teaching that we count the 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak, that wasn't the original intention. The original Kavanah was 400 years of slavery. But when Hashem is going to annul it, there has to be an ofan, a way in which the Gezeira is fulfilled. You know, an example would be, you know, there's an old Chassidish minhag that on Erev Yom Kippur, when people eat, mitzvah to eat, there's a mitzvah to eat crumbs of cake on Erev Yom Kippur. Why is that so? Because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu was gozer on you, that you have to be a beggar in the course of the year, a beggar like living on crumbs, so the Gezeira is Mekuyam in that way. You find such concepts that you try to find, and hope that Hashem and his Rachamim will agree with you, in an innocuous, harmless way that a Gezeira can be fulfilled. Even the notion of breaking a plate, you know, at a Tanoim, right, when the couple gets engaged, or whether it's at the Chasana, they do a formal Tanoim, or they do a Tanoim at a L'chaim, or not L'chaim Vort, I don't know, L'chaim Vort, I don't know the difference myself. These days, my day, they didn't have L'chaim and a Vort, but okay. Now, the reason why we break a plate is not the same reason why we break a glass. It's really two different minhagim. The breaking of a glass at a chuppah is based on the Gemara in Brachos that says that at a time of great joy, we are supposed to still remember the Chorban Beis HaMikdash, and it's designed to mute our joy, and that's why many people say or sing at the time that we break the glass, in Meshkekech Yerushalayim, right? If I forget Yerushalayim, in Tishkech Yemini, I should forget my right hand. That's why also many people think it's inappropriate, and Eretz Yisrael is a little different because of the timing, but in the typical American chasna, and many chasnas are that way in Eretz Yisrael too, if it's an American chasna, they break the glass after the Sheva Brachas under the Chuppah, and as soon as they break the glass, people explode into loud singing and dancing. People say, it's a little inappropriate. I mean, the concept of breaking the glass is like a moment of sadness and reflection. It's not the time, like, it's not like when they finish the national anthem at a baseball game, start screaming. Now, the way they do it in Eretz Yisrael, timing, you actually have a little of that, because they break the glass, again, many times they do the American minhag, but the Yerushalmi minhag is that they break the glass after, either before they read the ksuba or right after they read the ksuba, before Sheva Brachas. So at that point, nobody's singing and dancing yet, as opposed to after Sheva Brachas. Okay. But be it as it may, the reason why the mother... I don't know. I don't really know the origin of why in America they switched it. But I know that, you know, in most American classes, you know, they go crazy with the breaking of the glass, which is precisely the time at which we're supposed to be Mesabel over Yerushalayim. I've heard the Misakri Kedushin announce, or at least the announcer say, the Rosh Yeshiva has requested that we pause for 5 seconds or 10 seconds after the breaking of the glass before we sing to remember the Beis HaMikdash. But the reason I'm bringing this up is the breaking of the plate, right, when they sign the tanoim, the engagement contract. So the mothers-in-law take a plate and they hold it together and they break it. That is not because of that. That's a totally separate minhag. And that's based on another Gemara. The Gemara says that in every marriage there are going to be machlokas, they're going to be fighting, disagreements, particularly about financial matters. The ksuba, right, things like that. So memela, the idea is, sometimes when people fight, they break things, right? They throw pots and pans, whatever it is. So the concept is, it's the same idea as eating the crumbs, that if it was decreed in Shamayim that in this marriage, crockery, dishes are going to be broken, let it be mekoyim in this way. In other words, there is a concept that Hashem doesn't just annul decrees, but he has to find some less, not always innocuous, but some other way. So that's the idea of the recounting, meaning the recalibration from the birth of Yitzchak was because the Gezerah could not be carried out in the way it was supposed to be carried out. So the Medrash has to find other ways, meaning to say, Hashem takes us out, but we didn't have our 400 years. So the Medrash gives a few answers. One answer is, it's 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak. Now you might say, well, why should the birth of Yitzchak count? I mean, after all, we weren't in Egypt. Well, the answer is Hashem didn't say Egypt. Hashem said a land that's not theirs. And even in Yitzchak's own lifetime in Eretz Yisrael, he often felt like a stranger. They filled up his wells and the like. But the Medrash gives a few other answers as well. In other words, how do you recalibrate? How do you shoehorn the 210 into 400? Answer one, recalibrate from counting from the birth of Yitzchak. Answer two is that the extraordinary, unusual, supernatural population growth of Am Yisrael had the same number of man hours over 210 years. If you look at the number of hours, right, over 400 years, a normal population would have worked X number of hours. So this was twice as large a population as might be expected, etc. Hashem calculated it, that the number of hours worked by a larger population would have been equal to the number of hours that would have been worked by the normal population. And the third answer the Medrash gives us is that, going back to the idea that the Egyptians went beyond Hashem's decree, that the qualitative magnitude of the suffering was so much greater than would have been even a normal slavery. So the kaishi, hashibut, of 210 equal kind of the magnitude of suffering over 400. So think of Yaakov Kamenetsky says, Gavaldik, I mean, in ways that only Hashem could figure this out. And that is, the extra little pinch, the twist, that they had to gather their own straw, which was only for a very short time, that was needed to put them over the top. Meaning to say, Hashem cannot redeem them until the quantum of suffering that should have been extended over 400 years was realized in a shorter time. But they have to be redeemed because they're approaching the 50th level of Tumah. So Hashem has to make it a little bit worse in order to hit that line. So that's what the Medrash means. The very Lashon of Oz that you're using as your complaint is the Oz that is the basis of your redemption. Which is an amazing thing. I mean, obviously, we know the basic idea that the suffering that we go through is a kapara, it's an atonement, etc. We never know what it might be making up for, but here you see a specific example that the kaishi hashibud was not simply Hashem making things worse before they got better, but rather lehepech, it had to get worse before it could get better. Because otherwise, according to at least that medrash, you have the other answer, but at least like that medrash, you needed the kaishi hashiva to be mashlim to complete the chiyuv of the 400 years. Yeah.
Why is it like that? Like Hashem has to stick with the 400 years, but just change.
Well,
sometimes even it says it like when he doesn't even say it out before. Like if he decides it, then.
Yeah, it's hard to understand exactly because it sounds like the minhagim of the kings of Persia, right? That's what we see. Kings of Persia, they make a law they cannot repeal their own law, right? That's why Ahasuerus, who decrees that all the Jews should be killed on the 13th of Adar, he can't take back that decree. He can only say the Jews have the right to get weapons and fight back and everything else, right? Because that was the minhag. It's a complicated question. It goes back to the idea of God being perfect. And because God is perfect, nothing Hashem says can ever be annulled, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu will allow it to be reinterpreted and redefined based on the Maisa B'nei Adam. See, this is the trick that Hashem has to face, because everything Hashem does is perfect, but Hashem is responding to the actions of human beings that are imperfect. Right? So how do you get Hashem's word to be inviolate and fixed and perfect when it all depends on what we do? And the short answer is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's gezeros are susceptible to many types of interpretations, and Hashem will make an interpretation available that can mitigate the gezera, but it still has to. Now, the Amos says there are lashonis of Chazal that don't say like this. I mean, for example, when we talk about Tshuva, Tefillah, Tzedakah, so Mavirin is not such a bad, that just means Hashem causes it to go away. That's not a contradiction, but the lashon of Korin Gezardin, it rips a Gezardin. Rips a Gezardin doesn't have a mashmos of what I'm saying. In other words, the way we're saying it now, nothing ever gets ripped. It just gets reinterpreted, recalibrated. It finds a different manifestation in a lenient way. So l'char, one has to have an aura that there seems to be a musik of a kriyas gezardin, which is a little different. You have to be mayan taka. Is the Darchei Hashem in every case a redefinition, or can there just be an annulment, a simple annulment? Like, what do we say if you say Yehi Shmei Rabba in Kaddish, V'chol Kaichai, and there's a machlekes, does Kol Kaichai mean all of your kavana, or does Kol Kaichai mean all of your, you know, the loud voice? But whatever it is, even if there was a gezar din against a person for 70 years, it gets ripped up. So that's in mind. Yeah.
If the breaking of the plate at the engagement is supposed to be a fulfillment of any possible bad decrees for the marriage,
yeah,
then how does it function like that, given that the plate is broken before they're married?
That's a good point. That's a good point. But it's interesting. You know, it may be an interesting anachronism, because it used to be in the time of Chazal, the Erisin, which is actually the first stage, was done a year before. And the Ksuva would be signed when they already were married, albeit not living together. Your argument is that since now, we don't do anything until afterwards. It's a good point. I mean, the minhag seems to have originated from the time when the Erisin was before this. But it is good. But still, I guess we say that, once you're in the wedding hall, you know, the marriage is kind of starting at that point. So that's why we do it. What is Tanam? Tanam is an engagement. Now, why do we do a Tanam on the day of the wedding? Or at the wedding. That makes no sense. So the answer is, Hasidim do it earlier at Elchan. They actually sign a Tanam and everything else. They break a plate then, which is even earlier. But the reason is, there's a very big Aveira to break a Tanam. Some even say that if after the Tanaim it's discovered that they don't want to get married, it's better to go through the marriage and get a get than break a Tanaim. So Ashkenazim want to play it safe. We don't want them to sign a formal engagement commitment until we're pretty sure that they're not going to back out of it. So we wait until the wedding itself. Our assumption is, and although it has happened even that, but our assumption is, at the wedding hall, they're probably going to go through with it. If you did it 6 months earlier, maybe they wouldn't go through with it. Right? All right. But anyway, this is the idea. Now, I'll give you a story that I heard, a very interesting story about how we don't always know. We don't always know how the difficulties that happen to us are really a Kodesh Baruch Hu accepting something lesser to neged a gezeira ra. The story was, there was a yeshiva buffer that was walking, and all of a sudden his Rosh Yeshiva started, who was known as a Balmidos and a very idle person, started screaming at him, calling him an idiot and a Rosha, and no one understood. I mean, why was he attacking this kid, and why was her she was behaving this way? And it turned out the following. It turned out that the Rosh Hashiva saw, somehow, he saw over the boy's head the Malach HaMavis, that there was a gezeira of death on this child. And he remembered, or she remembered, and I knew the Gemara, that when you publicly embarrass somebody, it's like you're killing him. So the Rosh Hashiva said, I wanted him to have the gezeira of Mavis, Mekuyim in this way, so that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would accept it as a tumura, as a substitute for the actual gezeira of death that was added. So that's what he said to him. I know the Rosh Hashiva must have been like a Baal Baruch HaKadosh. I don't think it would be Stam Rosh Hashiva. You know, normally though, doesn't have those types of visions or whatever it is. But maybe it was Chassidus or Rebbe. I don't remember. I don't know if I ever know. I don't know if the story brought down who it was. But be it as it may, you see this idea that if a person suffers embarrassment, humiliation, it might literally be a substitute, God forbid, for something like that. Right? So that's an important thing. And that's what the Medrash means, that the us, you are misowning against Hashem with us, that very us that you're complaining about is going to be the source of your redemption.
How would that rabbi who embarrassed the student in order to get rid of the Malach HaMavis respond to the fact that, whatever we might see, we're still obligated to do what God tells us to do, and that's to not embarrass someone?
Well, it is a good question. I mean, his argument was, it was pikuach nefesh, right? His argument was that if this child would die unless I embarrass him, I mean, that's a simple question. Can I embarrass somebody to prevent him, let's say he's about to touch something that's going to give him a 2,000-volt shock, and I can't reach him, and the only way I can stop him is by humiliating him so he doesn't move any further, right? So, b'chayra, for pikuach nefesh, I'm allowed to embarrass him, right? So, Rebbe held, this was a massive of pikuach nefesh.
What about, one of the guess is Tamar and Yehuda?
That's a little different, because what that case means is you can't embarrass somebody to save your life, but you can embarrass somebody to save his life, right? That's the Nafkamina. So that would be the difference, yeah.
Can person A embarrass person B to save person C's life?
Maybe not. So that might be so. In other words, you can't be, because given the fact that you can't kill A to save B, so maybe you can't embarrass A to save B, right? But the one thing we can say is, I think it makes a lot of swara, that I can embarrass A to save A, mm-hmm. because A is the one that I'm actually saving in that case. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Lamaisa, though, Taisus Lamaisa says that Shulok HaLacha, the statement, in other words, right, you know, just to go, I'm sure everyone knows the Gemara about Tamar, that Tamar did not reveal who the man she was Mizana with until Yehuda came forward and admitted, because, as the Gemara says, it is better for a person to throw themselves in a fiery furnace before they embarrass. And the Rishonim explain the following. They explain that since embarrassing somebody is like murdering them, so you can't murder somebody to save your life, right? That would be the cheshbon. But L'maisa, the Rishonim say that's not L'halacha. L'halacha L'maisa, we paskin. That in fact you are allowed to embarrass somebody to save your life. It's not one of the three cardinal sins, even though it's a very severe sin. And Tomer's behavior was going beyond the letter of the law. Although the Rambam says there's no such thing as going beyond the letter. The Rambam says whenever you don't have to give up your life, you're not allowed to. But many Rishonim say there's a concept of being permitted to give up your life for any mitzvah, and Tomer was willing to do that. I think the consensus of Jewish history has been not like the Rambam. I mean, the Rambam basically says there's no such thing as voluntary martyrdom. You are either obligated to give up your life for a very small number of sins, or you're absolutely forbidden to give up your life. I think we see in many cases Yidden have voluntarily given up their life for Kiddush Hashem, and this was considered to be a holy thing. And so it's much better that we don't paskin like the Rambam in those difficult cases. Okay, I have to go. We'll stop here, and we'll continue with this on Tuesday.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, go ahead.